Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Tammy Sapp. I represent Goodman Associates, LLC, the appellant herein. As the court is aware, this case involves the priority of a judgment lien and an amendment thereto obtained by my client, Goodman Associates. The judgment lien was originally recorded in December 2008, against certain real property that I'll just refer to as Lot 13. Lot 13 was subsequently purchased in January 2009, by defendant Winter Quarters, LLC, and that purchase was financed by co-defendant Capital West National Bank. And I'll just refer to Winter Quarters and Capital West National Bank as defendants herein. Now, despite the fact that defendants had constructive notice of Goodman's valid perfected judgment lien at the time of the purchase, they refused to pay that lien. Instead, they decided to take a gamble, hoping that if the judgment could be set aside, they would not have to pay Goodman anything at all. If they hadn't made this gamble and simply paid off the lien, Goodman, when they first realized of the mistake, Goodman would not have incurred any additional fees at all. But they decided to roll the dice, and they lost. Ultimately, Goodman won by Supreme Court rule that the lien was valid, that his judgment should be reinstated, nunc pro tunc. The consequences and the burden of the defendant's decision to gamble in this case should rest on them, not on Goodman.
I've got a question about that. When we're talking about who's gambling in the subsequent litigation, Winter Quarters and Capital West weren't really parties at that point. Instead, it was WP Mountain Properties, correct?
Sort of. At that point, it was WP Mountain Properties, but shortly after they became aware of the lien, and by they, I mean Winter Quarters and Capital West, Goodman also commenced a foreclosure action. And it wasn't until the foreclosure action was commenced that the defendants and WP Mountain Properties hired the same counsel to file a motion to set aside the judgment and also defend in the foreclosure action. And so, yes and no is the answer to your question. They weren't a party to the underlying litigation that formed the basis for the judgment, but they were a party to the foreclosure action, and they were represented by the same counsel representing WP Mountain.
Aside from having the same counsel, is Winter Quarters and Capital West able to control the ferocity of the litigation between WPMP and Goodman? I mean,
no,
who are these two people litigating, and aside from having the same counsel, how can they keep the costs down?
No, they weren't able to control it, but they could have just simply paid off the lien at any time, and they refused to do it. And they were aware of all of the arguments that were being made in that underlying litigation because they were represented by the same counsel. They knew that all along, and even before any litigation was commenced, that Goodman was always going to make a claim for the additional fees, interest, and costs that he was incurring on a daily basis. And that's evidenced by correspondence in the record and communications between Goodman, Capital West, and their title carrier.
If they could have just paid off the initial lien, they're not saying that they're not responsible for that amount. They're just protesting the additional. And so why is it the fact that they could have paid off the initial lien suddenly making them responsible for more than the amount that they could have paid off and will pay off?
Right. Well, the issue goes to notice, really. And they were on notice that there was a judgment lien here, that judgment had entered on December 4th, 2008, and that the time for appeal had not expired and the time for amendment had not expired. And if you take those facts, and that gives them an inquiry notice obligation. And under inquiry notice obligation, the duty to investigate arises. If they had done any investigation at all, they would have known that Goodman's lien also and judgment consisted of not only a principal amount, but attorney's fees under a fee-shifting provision in the underlying case. So, yes, they always knew that this was a potential and yet failed to do anything about it.
So is your argument that that under the recording statute, you're not only on notice of what has already happened, but you are going to take responsibility for what may but has not yet happened?
In certain circumstances. And under the Winkler case, that sets forth that any party who buys a property that is subject to appeal, that has a judgment and it's subject to appeal, and the time for appeal has not yet expired, takes that property subject to any change that may happen on appeal, which is exactly what happened here.
Does that make a difference, though, that the change didn't happen on appeal but happened under 60B?
I don't think so. And if you look closely at the Winkler case, that case actually was a 60-day appeal provision following an administrative decision. So there's the 45-day appeal under Rule 4, which the underlying district court in this case acknowledged that certainly if there had been an appeal within that time, defendants would have been obligated. And then there's the Rule 60B, which is what the motion to set aside in this particular underlying litigation was filed under, which is a six-month deadline, and that would not expire until June 2nd, 2009.
So a title insurance company that issues an opinion or a policy, they're exposed. If they insure around the judgment that is actually filed of record, and somehow subsequently the judgment holder ends up getting an attorney's fees award, the title insurance company is on the line for that.
I would think so. That's not a fact that I'm aware of. I know that there's a title company involved here, although the policy itself is not part of the record in this case, which raises another good point. Goodman here is truly the only victim in this case. He had no other option other than to defend its judgment and protect and prosecute its lien, whereas the defendants in this case could have gone back to the seller of the property, asked them to disgorge the funds, to help set off the funds that they received in the purchase price to set off this lien. They had a title company, possibly, we don't know that for a fact, that they could go seek some sort of redress from. So in this case, it is Goodman that is the victim and not the defendants here, not Winter Quarters and CapWest. They had other options available to them, but instead they decided to join forces with WP Mountain Properties, hire the same counsel, and fight vigorously to avoid paying this lien.
But had they not done that, would your argument be any different? I mean, as I'm understanding what you're saying, is they were on inquiry notice. They were on inquiry notice as soon as they saw what was recorded. Upon inquiry, they could have determined that the judgment was subject to revision, and therefore, regardless of whether they had fought the fight.
Right. Regardless of whether, they would still be on the hook here because they were on inquiry notice.
So they're on inquiry notice that there has been litigation, and they need to check whether it is ongoing, and they need to anticipate that the litigation, there might be an amendment to the judgment, and that they're taking that risk.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, they did. Because they had a counsel that was involved in the underlying litigation, not only were they on inquiry notice of what happened in that underlying litigation, they in fact knew what was going on in that underlying litigation all along. To argue that they're innocent here is simply untrue. That's not the case. They knew all along what was going on in that underlying litigation. They knew exactly how vehemently it was being disputed, and they knew that it went up to the Supreme Court, and that all along Goodman was asking for his attorney's fees to be tacked onto that judgment. I want to address the errors that were made by the district court in this case. In reaching its conclusion, the district court found that the defendants had no notice of the subsequent litigation, which we've covered. But by not following the law of Winkler v. Andrus, which requires that anyone who purchases property after judgment takes that property subject to any changes affecting title on appeal. And though the district court noted that the time for appeal had not yet expired, for some reason it refused to acknowledge and apply the law of Winkler. We've already discussed it, but the holding in Winkler should also be applied to this case, and apply to Rule 60B motions as to any third-party purchasers. In addition, the second error that the district court made was that by not following the rule of law in Martinez or the Delta County land cases, which set forth the standards for inquiry notice in Colorado, namely that the purchaser's duty to investigate is triggered when the records disclose some outside condition. Here, certainly the transcript of judgment, noting the judgment date of December 4, 2008, triggered that duty, that the time for appeal or amendment had not yet expired, and that this purchaser should inquire further. A reasonable investigation would have revealed the nature of the lien and the fact that Goodman's judgment was based on costs and attorney's fees, at least in part. In addition, had the defendants inquired before they purchased the property from Goodman, they would have known, surely, because Goodman, throughout the record, is continuing to state that his fees and costs are increasing by the day. They would have known, at least as of the date of purchase, had they inquired about that lien, that Goodman continued to assert this position. And finally, the district court committed error when it found that defendants did not have notice giving rise to the amended judgment nunc pro tunc. That's just simply not the case, as we've already gone through. They were not only aware of those things, they were actively involved in it and participating in that litigation. And I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Ms. Sapp, you have 2 minutes and 13 seconds remaining.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm Tom Devine. I represent the appellees, Capital West National Bank and Winter Quarters LLC. The panel is today presented with a unique circumstance that represents a matter of first impression in not only Colorado, but in every jurisdiction in this country. The facts specific to this case have never been addressed by any court in any jurisdiction, and so we find ourselves in a situation applying established Colorado law and the spirit and intent of the Recording Act under which the title record in this case was established. On the one hand, this panel is presented the opportunity to interpret the Recording Act consistently with its plain language and with its spirit and intent. On the other hand, the appellant is asking the court to apply an additional factor to a race notice statute, which would essentially establish a buffer period for any recorded document for up to 6 months in the event that the recorded document of whatever type might be either appealed or attacked within the judiciary. That approach is not supported by the race notice statute, nor is it supported by any case law in Colorado or in any other jurisdiction.
Well, Mr. Devine, it's more than that, isn't it? It's not just appealed or attacked, it's amended.
That's true.
And as I understand the argument Ms. Sapp is making, she's saying that you file a judgment of record, and those who assess the record they're liable for an amendment of that judgment at a later time.
The analysis revolves around the operative date for the inquiry notice analysis. In this case, Cap West, which I'll define as both Capital West and Winter Quarters for simplicity, is charged with notice of the judgment lien. And that is all there is to it. They were unaware of it for facts not within the record and irrelevant to this analysis. But as of January 9th, when Cap West closed on that property, subject to a judgment lien of which neither WPMP nor Cap West was aware, they took the property, Cap West did, subject to the $152,000 judgment lien. As of January 9th, the record does reveal what inquiry notice would have revealed. On inquiry with either the Eagle County District Court or with Goodman or with WPMP reveals that there was no notice that the judgment lien was subject to increase by over 100% in the next 2 years.
What if there had been a lis pendens? I mean, doesn't a lis pendens do that?
And a lis pendens is required by statute. And a lis pendens was not on record as of January 9th, 2009.
Doesn't a lis pendens put someone on notice that there is something that is not yet resolved that clouds the title and you're taking subject to the ultimate resolution?
Absolutely. And that is the purpose of the lis pendens portion of the Recording Act statute. There was no lis pendens filed in this case. So what the inquiry would have revealed is you go to the Eagle County District Court and the pleadings are within the record, would have revealed that Eagle County had closed the case, had administratively closed the case because the judgment had been entered. Goodman himself would not have known that he was going to be incurring appellate fees as of January 9th, 2009 because he did not start incurring fees in earnest until the default judgment was moved to be set aside in May of 2009. WPMP was the subject of the default judgment because he was unaware of service. That is within the Colorado Supreme Court opinion saying that the service was effective on his agent, his secretary at his regular place of business. However, Mr. Hermes was unaware of the service. So inquiring with either the court from which the transcript of judgment originated, with Goodman himself, or with WPMP at the time of the inquiry notice obligation, January 9th, 2009, would not have revealed anything other than the transcript of judgment for $152,000 accruing interest at 8%, which Cap West is on the hook for and an obligated for, and in fact has been paid. So what is remaining is approximately $130,000, still apparently with the clock ticking, for attorney's fees. And I suggest to the court that the nature of damages sought by Goodman in this case reveals that the district court's order was sound. Attorney's fees may only be awarded by contract or by statute. The contract that awards attorney's fees to Goodman is between WPMP and Goodman. Cap West has nothing to do with that contract. So any award of attorney's fees arising out of this litigation is the fault of WPMP and the obligation of WPMP, who I note is not a party to this foreclosure action. Second, there is no statute authorizing attorney's fees in this sort of litigation as between Cap West and Goodman. So what Goodman is trying to do is to backdoor its attorney's fees incurred after Cap West took title to Lot 13 for attorney's fees incurred in litigation with WPMP after Lot 13 was no longer owned by WPMP and get an award of those attorney's fees against Cap West under an amended judgment from July 2010, which does not attach to Lot 13 because at the time of the amended judgment, WPMP no longer owned Lot 13. That judgment attaches to all interests and property of WPMP as of July 1st, 2010. And although not before the court, I would suggest that that order, as between Goodman and WPMP, is nunc-pro-tunc and effective as against WPMP. However, to the extent that this is a matter of first impression in Colorado, we do have some Colorado Supreme Court directive to lead the way. First is the case of Purdue versus Purdue, which is a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1937, which is 64 Pacific 2nd 602, which is cited in all the briefs. Judgments may not be entered nunc-pro-tunc when they adversely affect an intervening party.
Is that the holding in that case?
I suppose that there's a dispute between the parties as to what the ultimate holding of Purdue is, but I would suggest to you that given the scant amount of authority on the subject, that direction from the complete Colorado Supreme Court is at least binding or authoritative in this matter.
It was a reference to the Corpus Juris, was it? It was a quote from Corpus Juris?
I don't know. You caught me off guard on that one.
If a list pendants had been filed, and I understand one wasn't until after the purchase, then would you agree that CapWest would be responsible for an amended judgment if it were amended on the basis of a mistake and not necessarily attorney's fees added in?
Yes, and that is the clear statutory scheme, and the purpose of a lease pendants is to provide notice to any potential purchaser, hey, there's something going on here. If you take this property subject to the lease pendants, you're taking this property subject to whatever that lease pendants and that litigation might reveal, reflect, amend, or result in.
You're limiting it to an amendment that would be in effect as to the judgment and not just the addition of attorney's fees that you normally wouldn't be liable for under contract, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And the fact that a lease pendants has not been recorded is not dispositive of the issue, but it certainly supports the position of the inquiry notice of January 9th, 2009. I want the court to be cautious about the allegation of complicity between CapWest and WPMP. Those facts are not within the record and they're not supported by the record. The only nexus between CapWest and WPMP is the fact that they're represented by the same counsel in parallel litigation. Please do keep in mind that the attorney's fees that were incurred between WPMP and Goodman were in a case filed in Eagle County, which is case number 2008 CV411. That's the default action. The CapWest foreclosure action was filed in Grand County, 2009 CV61, and that action had hardly any activity in it because it was stayed pending the outcome of the default and the appeal to the Supreme Court.
Goodman relies fairly heavily on this Winkler case.
Correct.
And so I wanted to ask, is there any reason, if Winkler stands for the proposition that you have inquiry notice as to the period of an appeal, if there's any reason not to extend that to the 60B situation, say an additional 6 months?
I will contend to this court that Winkler does not stand for that proposition in any regard. The Winkler case deals with an administrative law judge decision that had been entered at the time someone decided to take an oil and gas lease subject to that administrative law judge decision. Subsequently, I believe the Bureau of Land Management appealed that decision, and whatever the result of the appeal was negative to the person who took the assignment of the oil and gas lease, which the assignee had knowledge of at the time he took the assignment. And what Winkler says is, when you do that, when you know, when you have actual knowledge that there is litigation or there's a pending decision on your property interest, and you take the interest subject to that pending decision, you do that at your own peril. The distinction between Winkler, apart from it being under the United States Code as opposed to the Colorado statutes, apart from it being a federal district from Wyoming, and apart from it dealing with administrative law judge decisions and the Bureau of Land Management, Winkler stands for the proposition that if you have actual notice that what you are taking is subject to attack and in fact is presently under attack, you take it subject to that attack. Winkler is clearly distinguishable on both the facts and the law, because in this case, inquiry notice would not have provided CapWest with any information or understanding as to pending litigation or attack of that judgment lien. So they took it, took the property, the title to Lot 13, subject to the $152,000, and nothing else, because no inquiry, whether extremely cautious, prudent, or of any nature, would have revealed that that judgment was subject to increase by that amount. I will also note to the court that the Recording Act that we're operating under does contain two relation back exceptions. One is the after acquired title statute, which is 38-30-104, which provides that if a grantee takes title to property when the grantor did not strictly have the right to be selling the property at the time, but later acquires the title, that the title is deemed to go back to the date that the grantee thought he was getting good title. So it's the after acquired title statute. It says you can relate back title in that one circumstance. The second exception is under the future advances statute, which is 38-39-106, which is for deed of trust in mortgage situations for revolving lines of credit or second loans under the same deed, which says that if a single lender is lending money to a property owner and the deed says that there may be a revolving line of credit where future money is extended or that additional money may be extended on a second loan, all of the money extended by that single lender to that single debtor is related back to the first date for priority purposes. Those are the only two exceptions in the Recording Act for relation back. When there are specific exceptions to a statute, it tells the court and the lawyers that the Colorado legislature considered relation back and said relation back applies in these two circumstances. When there are those two circumstances, it relates back, but there is no relation back except for under those circumstances. And I would suggest to you that as a matter of statutory interpretation, the existence of relation back exceptions within the Recording Act that do not include what Goodman is trying to do here precludes Goodman from being able to relate back under the Recording Act.
That equitable principle sometimes overrides statutes, so like equitable subrogation in the context of priority liens?
Absolutely, and I would agree with you. And if there's a balancing of the equities analysis to be done here, we've got Goodman, who I do not dispute has been wronged by WPMP. WPMP withheld earnest money from a purchase that fell through, refused to return that money, then was sued, and there was a default judgment, and then moved to set aside the default judgment. WPMP is an at-fault party, and as between WPMP and Goodman, absolutely. Whatever nunk-pro-tunk and relation-back analysis needs to happen on an equitable basis between WPMP and Goodman might as well happen, except that that's not before the court. The question is whether an intervening third party who had no knowledge on either actual or inquiry notice can be held liable for the wrong of WPMP in whatever you want to construe its wrong as, either being refusal to return the money or participating in an appellate process that was extremely costly. The intervening nature of PacWest's interest reveals that the balancing of the equities does not weigh heavily in favor of Goodman, nor in favor of PacWest in this regard. So I would contend to you that the balancing of the equities analysis is not a useful method of analyzing how to resolve this issue, and we should resort to statutory interpretation. And the statutes are plain and clear in favor of PacWest in this regard. If you have no further questions or comments for me, I do not need the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Devine. Ms. Sapp?
Thank you. Defendants are confusing what inquiry notice is. Defendants would have the court believe that inquiry notice is looking at the documents filed as of record and simply stopping there. Defendants are arguing to the court that the only duty that they had upon inquiry notice was to look at the transcript of judgment, and they were only on notice of exactly what that transcript of judgment said. But inquiry notice requires more than that. The inquiry notice duty was triggered because the judgment date was so recent and at the time, and it required them to investigate further. A further investigation means you go to that court, the Eagle County District Court, and look at the nature of that suit. Had they bothered to do that, they would have found the nature of Goodman's claims, they would have found a copy of the contract attached to the complaint, and they would have found the order that was the basis for the judgment lien.
Seth, I understand that your argument is that the inquiry notice might require someone to go beyond the documents that were actually filed, but here aren't you going even another step, not just requiring them to look beyond the documents, but to actually anticipate future litigation?
Well, they had to anticipate future litigation because the time for appeal had not yet expired. I mean, if you're going to take property knowing that the time for appeal has not yet expired and roll the dice hoping that that judgment is stricken down, then you better be on notice of what the consequences of that gamble is. And here the consequences are there's going to be more fees, and they took that chance knowingly. I also want to address another issue, and that is the case of Purdue versus Purdue. The holding in that court was to recognize the court's equitable powers to enter a judgment to relate back. And that's what that court did in Purdue. In that holding, they found that there was no innocent third party in that case. And that case is fully briefed in the reply brief. I'm out of time. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Sapp.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Devine. Your arguments to both counsel were excellent. They were helpful to us. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.